Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night from 2014, adapted by Anna Lily Amirpour from her own 2012 short film of the same name, which she also wrote and directed. This was the first feature for Amirpour, who was born in England to Iranian parents and moved to America at an early age, and it's safe to say she made something of a splash with it. She was nominated for 2 Independent Spirit Awards, an Audience Award at Sundance, and she won several awards at the Sitges Film Festival and the Gotham Awards. Ever since then, she's been seen as someone to watch in the field of independent genre film, and despite controversy over her follow-up The Bad Batch, she was unprepared for a line of criticism related to the film's violence against black characters, and gave a response that many thought was unduly defensive, she's continued to draw acclaim for her work, including a recent standout episode of Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities series for Netflix. Although, yes, speaking of controversy, I do feel like I have to address the claims that she dressed in brownface for a Halloween costume in the early 2010s. Amirpour claims that she didn't darken her skin, and that the people who saw the photos made unwarranted assumptions about her race due to the emotionally charged situation surrounding the Bad Batch, but I haven't been able to find the photos, so I can't comment on them myself. Either way, Amirpour has scrubbed her social media profile and no longer posts publicly. All that was still very much in her future, though, when producer Elijah Wood, yes, that Elijah Wood, he's used his Frodo Baggins money to become a Hollywood producer, and his company SpectreVision champions a lot of weird and wonderful genre films that might not otherwise have gotten made, agreed to fund a feature-length version of A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Although set in Iran, Amirpour chose to film in California to avoid state censorship, but she did make a conscious choice to write the dialogue in Persian, there are English subtitles, but you could be forgiven for thinking this was an Iranian film, and she chose to use an Iranian cast. That cast begins with Sheila Vand, who plays the titular girl. She's been acting since 2007, with a standout role in the Oscar-winning film Argo and a recurring part as Courtney on the TV series Prom Queen prior to shooting this movie, and regular roles since then in shows like Snowpiercer and State of Affairs, and movies like The Rental and Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Horror fans might also know her as Carla from the segment The Birthday Party in the all-female-directed horror anthology XX. The male lead, Arash, is played by Arash Marandi, who is born in Tehran and holds dual Iranian and German citizenship. As you might imagine from someone who splits time between Iran and Germany, he doesn't have a whole lot of credits in American film and television, but he did appear in the supernatural horror movie Under the Shadow in 2016, which is also set in Iran, and the TV series Tehran for Apple TV. Arash's father, Hossein, credited somewhat questionably as Hossein the Junkie, is played by Marshall Manesh, who began acting in the 1970s as part of a theatrical troupe known as the Persian Theater Group before making the jump to film with James Cameron's 1994 movie True Lies. He was able to parlay that into a career playing Middle Eastern characters in film and television, from Barb Wire to Kazam to The Big Lebowski to Will and Grace to How I Met Your Mother. He's also one of only 2 actors who appear in both the short and the feature-length version of this story. Mind you, there were only 3 actors in the 7-minute short film. Playing Ati, who's credited, again somewhat problematically, as Ati the Prostitute, is Mozan Navabi, a playwright and actor from Los Angeles of Iranian descent who made a big splash with her one-woman show 9 Parts of Desire, in which she played 9 different Middle Eastern women. She's probably more recognizable to American audiences from her part as Ayla Sayad in House of Cards, or her lengthy stint as Samar Navabi on the TV show The Blacklist. Not to be confused with Blindspot, the show that made Critical Role fans miserable for several years, even though I absolutely did. Dominic Rains, the stage name for Amin Nazemzadeh, makes a short but immensely memorable appearance in this film as Saeed, credited as Saeed the Pimp. You may be picking up a theme here. Rains is the other actor who is also in the short version of this film, and he also did 36 episodes of General Hospital, an extended appearance on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as the Kree commander Cassius, and a very lengthy stint as Dr. Crockett Marcel on the shows Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, and Chicago Med. I'm really glad to see all these people still working, because independent genre movies don't always raise an actor's profile the way they should, and everyone in this movie is just riveting on screen. Although for some people, acting is legitimately something you move on from. Rome Shadanlu had some guest appearances on TV shows like How I Met Your Mother, The Middleman, and Dollhouse, but a few years after her role as Shida, the princess, in this film, she got heavily interested in alternative medicine and went back to school to get a degree in holistic psychology from Lesley University in Massachusetts. She now specializes in microdosing psychedelic mushrooms as a treatment for PTSD and stress-related physical ailments, and while I'll admit I view this kind of medicine with some skepticism, I also know that a lot of the medical establishment thinks of psychedelics as a field that deserves much more research than they've been allowed to do due to the moral panic regarding recreational drugs that's now consumed our culture for 60 years and counting. And with the major cast covered, and honestly just about the entire cast, this is one of those movies that could probably be turned into a stage play with only a little bit of work, let's dive in. We begin, after the usual profusion of studio logos, and this one does have a lot of them, with Arash smoking a cigarette and looking for his cat, who's played by a cat named Masuska, although the character is just the cat. It's worth mentioning here at the beginning that the entire film is in black and white, and while we've discussed a few movies that were shot without color for reasons of cost or practicality, I think this is the first time I've covered one that was done solely for artistic reasons. But it's obvious from the first frame why Amarpour chose to use black and white. She's interested in those high contrast images you get out of shooting without color, with Arash's cotton t-shirt standing out in striking counterpoint to the dark fences of the surrounding neighborhood. You get darker darks and brighter brights without color to get in the way, and Amarpour is clearly luxuriating in that effect. Similarly, the pale face of the girl contrasts with the darker fabric of her chador to make her pop against the night sky, which is a very impressive effect that she uses throughout the film. Arash finds the cat and walks off, heading down a series of cracked streets past slightly dilapidated houses as he heads home, observed by a genderqueer character named Rockabilly, who's played by Reza Safai as a kind of Greek chorus on events. The credits play over his journey, but the title card comes at the very end of the list of cast and crew, and I think you can tell a lot about this movie's politics just from its name. It's saying that there's something noteworthy about a woman who can walk down the streets by herself at night, something striking and unusual, which in turn reminds you that for most women, that's an act that carries no small amount of risk because there is always the chance that a man might see her as prey. This is going to be a film about women with power and the fear that causes in men primarily because they're used to being on top in the social order and a level playing field feels like it's tilted against them after so many years of enjoying unearned privilege. Arash passes a street urchin, played by Milad Iqbali, who asks him for money, and when Arash says he doesn't have any, the young boy points out that he's getting into a very nice classic car. It's a vintage Ford Thunderbird, and honestly, Arash's whole aesthetic feels very much like it's out of the 1950s. I've seen him compared to James Dean. Arash tells the boy he had to work for 2,191 days to earn the money to buy his car, which comes out to just about 6 years, so we can see immediately that he's someone who's accustomed to setting long-term goals and disciplining himself to achieve them, and that he's very, very attached to that car. We then see the oil wells of Bad City, although it's thankfully rarely called that on screen, because even though this is a movie that's working very much on the level of metaphor and allegory, I feel like it's still a little bit too on the nose when they say it out loud. Bad City is an oil town in Iran, and you don't need to know a lot about the history of the country to know that oil is a pretty politically charged topic for the region. The petroleum reserves discovered in the early 1900s led to a constant struggle for control of the region between the British and the Russians, one that ended in 1919 when the Russian Revolution ended the rule of the Tsars and left something of a political vacuum that the British tried unsuccessfully to fill. Instead, Iran became a monarchy, ruled first by Shah Reza Pahlavi and later by his son Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. And while it was initially hoped that their dynasty would become a constitutional monarchy, the younger Pahlavi got rid of his parliament and used American military support to establish a dictatorship. He instituted a number of reforms intended to modernize the country, in particular banning traditional Islamic headscarves and face coverings, which did very little to make the country seem Western in the eyes of the West, but did a lot to antagonize the culturally Muslim population. In 1979, the Shah was deposed and a theocracy was established with the secular president deferring to the religious supreme leader, which is still the situation in 2024. All of which is mostly backdrop for this film, because as I say, it's more of an allegorical movie, and Bad City feels less like a real place and more like a symbol of the human condition, but I do think it's important to have the historical context in mind here, because everybody acting in, writing, and directing the movie certainly did. Back at home, Arash's father Hossein is injecting himself with heroin between his toes, which indicates that he's enough of a habitual user that he has trouble finding a vein in his arm that hasn't been scarred too much to accept a needle, while he watches a strange ad on TV recruiting women to appear in porn. I'm obviously pro-sex work, but this does feel like it's a bit of a weird joke that doesn't quite land. Hossein gets a visit from his dealer, Saeed, who also has his fingers in a number of other illegal activities in Bad City, and from their conversation it sounds very much like Hossein might have overextended his credit with the intense, physically intimidating man. Arash seethes with frustration, well aware that Saeed's influence is in no small part responsible for his father's addictions and vices, but he understands that it's not wise to antagonize the violent criminal. And Saeed, for his part, isn't wrong in saying that Hossein is making his own choices and not some vulnerable child who's being exploited here. Saeed decides to settle the debt by taking Arash's car and drives off in it as Arash punches a brick wall in frustration and breaks his hand for his troubles. The next day, after reducing the swelling with ice and bandaging it up, he bikes to his job as groundskeeper and handyman for a wealthy family. The adult daughter, Shaida, calls him to her room to help her fix her television, and he asks her to leave so they won't be seen as doing anything inappropriate, before using the opportunity to steal her diamond earrings to buy back his car. It's a moment that feels a lot more tense on first viewing, when you don't quite know where the story is heading, and it's entirely possible that it's going to be a drama about a young man whose moment of moral weakness leads him into a downward spiral, and not a love story about a vampire. Spoilers. Speaking of, that night Saeed takes his new car out to check up on the sex workers he prostitutes, and we can see from his treatment of Adi that he's what you'd call a real piece of work. He pushes his finger into her mouth and coerces her into performing oral sex on him by withholding her share of the money she's earned. But he's spooked when he notices a woman wearing a chador watching them, and he doesn't let Adi finish, instead throwing her out of the car when she demands her cut. He drives away, telling her she'll need to work harder if she wants to make any money, and while this is sadly a reality of sex work for many women, it's definitely not going to be the dynamic between them for much longer. A quick aside for those who don't know what a chador is. For those women who follow the Muslim faith and its associated traditions, it's customary for them to cover the head for reasons of modesty. The simplest covering is a hijab, which is a simple scarf that covers the head. The chador is a longer garment, loose and flowing like a cloak, that goes down to the feet and can be pulled closed or left open like the girl does in this film. Both were banned by the Shah during his attempts to modernize the country, and then made mandatory by the Ayatollahs after the revolution. To this day, they're highly politicized garments the world over that are seen by some as a sign of the subjugation of women within Islam, and by others as a symbol of the faith that's been demonized by Islamophobes. There are other coverings such as the niqab and burqa that include veils for the face and even the eyes, but we don't really see them in this film. The woman in the chador, who's only credited as the girl and never named on screen, buys some jewelry and goes home to her modest apartment where she dances by herself to a song called Dancing Girls by Farah, while surrounded by posters of various 80s pop stars. Although the production was too cash-strapped to afford likeness rights, so it's a Madonna look-alike on the wall behind her. She does her makeup, then goes back out and contrives to accidentally encounter Saeed, who assumes it's his animal magnetism that draws her to him. According to foreignpolicy.com, he's actually got tattoos that say pimp clearly visible on his body, so this is a man who thinks he's full of alpha male energy. Saeed takes her back to his place, where he shows off his wealth and his drugs and his physique, completely failing to read the vibe the girl is giving off. She's not afraid of him. She's not impressed by him. She's wondering what his blood is going to taste like. Saeed opens his shirt and tries his go-to quote-unquote seduction move again, bringing his finger up to her mouth even though it should be blatantly obvious to him by this point that she's giving off a dangerous, even threatening energy. But he can't see a woman as a threat, or as anything other than a potential conquest, and even when her fangs pop out revealing her as a vampire, he still lets her suck on his finger as though he thinks he's somehow going to show off his supreme alphaness by seducing a literal monster. It should come as no surprise that he loses that finger, followed shortly afterwards by his life. The girl has no patience for men who mistreat women. Arash arrives on the scene shortly after the girl finishes her kill, planning to exchange the earrings for the car, and he's got a bit of himbo energy to him because he doesn't seem to connect the woman with the bloody mouth he sees leaving to the girl he's going to meet later. He goes inside, finds Saeed's body, and clearly isn't too broken up about it because he takes back the keys to his car along with a suitcase full of cash and drugs, and doesn't ask questions. Arash takes his prizes home while the girl returns to her place and washes off the blood. It should be mentioned that a lot of this film doesn't feature any dialogue at all, only montages set to music, and I've seen it compared to the films of Jim Jarmusch in the way it uses the characters not speaking to each other as a kind of silent conversation about feelings that don't translate well into words. Unfortunately, Jarmusch doesn't often work in horror, so I'm not going to be able to cover masterpieces like Ghost Dog for this podcast. But they're worth tracking down. The next day, Arash disposes of Saeed's body in a rubbish tip that's already full of similarly discarded corpses, and sells his drugs for cash that he uses to see a doctor about his injured hand. His father, meanwhile, joneses for a fix and tries to beg Addy for a freebie, but is turned down. He's clearly mad about it, but luckily for him, he doesn't try to take out his anger in the form of violence, because the girl is watching him. And it's clear from the way she stalks him without even caring whether or not he notices that she's accustomed to finding and killing misogynistic men. There's a wonderful moment where she intimidates him by precisely mirroring his movements from across the street that's both funny and scary at the same time. The girl then finds the street urchin and decides to start him off right in life by delivering a little warning about what happens to boys who grow up disrespecting women, popping her fangs and hissing at him to make sure he takes the lesson to heart. Oh, and mentioning that she can pop his eyes out of his skull and feed them to the dogs, and that she'll be watching him for the rest of his life. So, you know, a perfectly chill and proportionate measure to take with a 10-year-old. He drops his skateboard and runs, and she decides to keep it for herself and do a little late-night skateboarding. It's actually Amarpour in all the long shots. She's a lifelong skateboarder and knew exactly what she wanted the scene to look like. Arash comes home and makes dinner for his father, but all the older man is interested in is getting more heroin. Frustrated, Arash decides to make himself a Dracula costume and attend a party that Shida is going to, where you can see Amarpour in the background wearing skeleton makeup. He gives her some of his remaining stash of ecstasy as an attempt at flirtation, and she persuades him to take a pill himself. But it's clear that she isn't really into him due to the social gulf between them, and he doesn't handle his drugs especially well. It's not that he's having a bad trip, just one that's a lot more intense than he anticipated, and combined with Shada's rejection, it leaves him in no mood to enjoy the party. He tries to head home, but he's so high he winds up staring at a streetlight when the girl finds him. And weirdly enough, it turns out he's just her type. He's sweet, he's goofy, he's not intimidated by her, he's respectful of women, and he's vulnerable in a way a lot of men don't let themselves express. She winds up sitting him down on the skateboard when his legs go out from under him and wheels him back to her place, where the two of them listen to music and cuddle together in a scene that absolutely drips with sexual tension, even though they don't so much as kiss. It's a remarkably sweet moment, albeit one that's tinged with nerve-wracking fear because we know the girl could kill Arash at any time. Also, incidentally, this movie has a great soundtrack. I've sometimes joked that Anna Lily Amarpour is who Quentin Tarantino wants to be when he grows up, and one thing the two directors share is a note-perfect instinct for killer needle drops. This particular song is called Death by the band White Lies, and it's a fantastic mood setter. We then get a little wordless interlude where Rockabilly dances with a helium balloon in a symbolic gesture to the transience of any relationship between a mortal and an immortal. It's maybe a little pretentious, but it's pretty and it's short. It was originally much, much longer, and in fact a lot of Rockabilly scenes wound up on the cutting room floor. Filmmaking is almost as much about what you edit out as it is what you show, and turning an ensemble piece into a tightly focused character study centered on Arash and the girl is part of what gives this film its power. When we come out of the interlude, Arash and his father are having breakfast, and Hossein interrogates Arash about the woman he spent the previous night with and gets only vague answers in return. That night, Adi keys Arash's car, possibly thinking it to be Saeed's, or possibly thinking Arash killed Saeed, and the girl approaches her to deliver a gift of the many expensive pieces of jewelry she took off Saeed's corpse. Adi's obviously grateful for the money, but she recognizes the jewelry as belonging to her dead pimp, and you don't live in the marginalized world of illegal sex work without developing some instincts for danger. She wants to know why someone is giving her a ton of money and what they expect in return. But of course, the girl hasn't lived as long as she has because she blurts out, "Oh, I'm a vampire," the moment someone starts asking questions. She keeps the conversation vague and focused on Adi and naively hopes that money will change the younger woman's life. The girl feeds on an unhoused person on her way home, really the only nod in the whole movie to the traditional notion of vampirism as a curse that compels feeding, and finds a note from Arash on her doorstep asking to meet her at the nearby power plant the following night. She sleeps, dreaming of him as the light at the far end of a long, dark hallway, and the next evening she and Arash go out on something approximating an actual date. He brings her a hamburger she doesn't eat. They chat awkwardly about their favorite songs, and Arash gives her the diamond earrings he took from Shayda, even though her ears aren't pierced. But she hands him a safety pin, and after sterilizing it with a cigarette lighter, he pierces them on the spot with his bandaged hand while she hides the uncontrollable emergence of her fangs. It's quite possibly the weirdest romance in the history of cinema, and yet it's strangely beautiful. When Arash leans in to kiss her, though, she warns him that she's a bad person who's done bad things. He tries to convince her that life is fleeting and it's important to find happiness however you can with whoever you can, but she only walks away, knowing that her life is anything but fleeting, and there's just no way anything could possibly work out between them. Arash heads home, heartbroken, and although I feel like their romance shouldn't work, given how abrupt it is and how generally chilly and detached the movie's tone is, the tension of denying and deferring the physical aspect of their relationship goes a long way toward bridging the gap between what we see on screen and what we want to happen. We're constantly left in anticipation, to quote Frankenfurter, which helps us buy into the idea that this is a romance waiting to happen and not two odd, incompatible individuals. The next day, Hossein's withdrawal has become unbearable for him. He imagines the cat to be staring at him with his dead wife's eyes and smashes up the living room in frustration. Arash confronts him about his addiction, deciding in the end to give him the money for one last fix before kicking him out and cutting ties with his toxic family for good. He even gives him the cat, which just feels like an obvious mistake. This is not a man who can take good care of a pet, but it's definitely a Chekhov's abandoned animal situation, so we'll forgive him for now. Hossein and the cat go to Adi, who's still doing sex work because a single lump sum of money never lasts long, and it doesn't solve life's problems even if it does make things easier for a while, and she dances for him before he tries to convince her to shoot up with him. When persuasion fails, he forces the needle into her arm in one of the best examples I've seen of a symbolic rape that avoids the exploitative titillation of showing the act while still making it clear that a violation has occurred. But the girl knows what he did, and as we've already established, she has no patience for men who mistreat women. She bursts in and murders Hossein, drinking him dry right in front of Adi, then helps her dispose of the body because, as Hillary Clinton once said, there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women. The girl then leaves, taking the cat with her, whatever tenuous connection she shared with Adi destroyed by the act of savage violence that showed the younger woman her true and terrible self. I feel like in this moment, the movie is demonstrating the limits of vigilantism as a force for social change. In the end, you can't make someone's life better by simply killing all the bad people they're surrounded with. There's just too much complexity there for anything as simple as that, and Adi is a human being who shapes her circumstances as well as being shaped by them. It's not Adi's fault that she's in the situation she's in, but a single grand dramatic gesture won't keep her from falling back into it when her options are limited and sex work pays the bills where something else might not. The girl can't just swoop in and save people. It doesn't work that way. There's a whole series of tomorrows Adi has to go through, and she needs someone who's going to be there for the long haul if she's going to improve her life. And just in case it's not absolutely clear, improve her life in this case means getting her away from men who will physically and emotionally abuse her, not getting her out of sex work. Sex work is work, and the reason it's associated with crime and violence is because we've criminalized it and stripped away the legal protections from violence a sex worker might otherwise have. There is nothing wrong with Adi's career, only with the lack of support she receives on both a personal and a societal level, and honestly, a big part of the girl's naivete regarding Adi is her default assumption that she both can and should get her out of the profession. The next morning, the street urchin leads Arash to his father's body, and obviously, he's got a number of conflicted emotions about it. He feels naturally guilty for kicking his father out of the house, an act which he can't help believing led to Hossein's death, but there's also a sneaky, treacherous kind of relief that the end he always knew was coming is finally here and he doesn't have to keep holding everything together. Arash knew his father was on a downward spiral. He knew it would eventually end in either overdose or withdrawal or just a nasty death at the hands of someone he couldn't pay back for the drugs he was taking because Hossein isn't the kind of person who was going to pull himself out of this, and at least now it's over and Arash can live again. It's a complicated, messy set of feelings all conveyed with beautiful, wordless genius by the film, and it's no surprise that Arash wants to project it all onto whoever killed his dad. He asks the boy if he saw anything, in a wonderful parallel to the earlier confrontation the urchin had with the girl, but he's too frightened to speak. He knows what happens to little boys who are bad. Arash decides to leave town and packs up his few belongings and the suitcase full of cash and drugs that he's been judiciously hoarding. I feel like a lesser movie might have become about that suitcase and the people looking for it, turning the whole thing into a Tarantino-esque gangsters versus vampires action romp, but Amarpour is determined to find her own path through the material and the film is all the more interesting for it. Arash goes to visit the girl, asking her to come with him and leave Bad City behind for a new life somewhere better, and she wordlessly agrees, but then he sees the cat. It was Arash's cat, then it became Hossein's cat, and now it's the girl's cat. But really, it's Chekhov's cat, because it's the clue he needs to realize that the girl is his father's murderer. It's so wild to me to discover that the cat was a last-minute addition to the film. To me, it feels like the emotional centerpiece of the movie in this moment. But I guess serendipity is a thing sometimes. Arash doesn't say anything to her about it as they drive down the darkened roads out of Bad City. He's still processing what he's learned. Yes, Hossein was his father, and yes, the girl murdered him. But he loves her, and he's under no illusions about who the man was and what he was capable of and why someone might decide to kill him. Arash stops the car at a fork in the road and gets out, wordlessly contemplating everything about the choice he needs to make in a wonderful scene that needs no dialogue to convey everything important about the emotions of the characters involved. And finally he gets back in. He puts a tape in the tape player, starts the vehicle back up, and the two of them drive together into an uncertain future. How long can it last between them? How much can love do to bridge the unthinkable gap between a murderous vampire and a simple mortal man? We don't know, but we know they're going to try to find out. It's a hauntingly ambiguous ending to a hauntingly ambiguous movie, the kind of final shot true art is made of. I can't stress how confident and composed this is for a first feature. It feels like the work of a director who's been mastering their craft for decades, and it's going to live rent-free in my head for the rest of my life. Which does kind of answer the question, will I hang on to this movie? This is one I'd want even if I didn't notice that it recently wandered off of Shudder, where it's been for several years now, to other streaming services that aren't as accessible. This is true art, the kind of thing that even highbrow film critics can appreciate and admire and pretend isn't really horror so they can continue to believe that scary movies can't be artistic, and I'm so glad I managed to pick up a copy. The only thing I could possibly wish for is if the original short was on the DVD as a bonus feature, and I know that's just me being greedy. And if you want to talk about wordless visual poetry, the limits of vigilantism, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, there's another mutant baby in Seattle, and both Frank Davis and Lieutenant Perkins are headed that way to offer their unique perspectives on the case. But what if it's not just one baby? What if it's three? We're going to find out, as Larry Cohen warns us that it lives again. Or as it's sometimes known, it's alive, too. See you then.